You want to talk about it?
Sure. Give it a quick limit. I explained it to everybody else, but all I said was, before you got here, that she attributes the differences, you know, Jung's ambivalence to Neumann, to anti-Semitism. But then it's well known in the letters that Neumann disagreed with the very essence of Jung's ideas as far as the evolution of the God image and man's sacred task of consciousness.
Yeah, I mean...
And that's what I was... I thought that was an error. And then they call a Neumann Jung's heir apparent, which of course can't be if he disagrees in essence with Jung's ideas.
Yeah. Well, I get Nancy down here, so it's probably not fair. But, you know, I thought it's the typical... I have to gainsay Jung because he makes me feel small. So I'm big, and I sit above and shoot down. But that was only the details. I thought the basic feeling of her material was sound. I didn't like that. And Jung had conflicted relationships with the opposite sex. Can you tell me somebody who doesn't? They just have to be better than him, you know.
Well, she's conflicted. In the article, she says she's an atheist.
No, I didn't remember that.
She does.
No. Yeah.
And so you could see how Neumann's idea of no relationship between the evolution of consciousness and the God image would appeal to her if she's an atheist.
Yeah.
So that's what those are the things I mentioned to the group before you got here.
Yeah. I sent it. Everyone got it. I think I sent it around. Yeah.
Thank you.
I thought the basic tenet was against postmodernism, which I liked. Mm-hmm. And I was willing to forgive those lapses of judgment as I would see them. And, but it's so typical. You know, it's hard to read something where somebody actually sits down and says, now, let's see what that guy really has to say. I think I'll keep my mouth shut until I understand it. It's like almost non-existent, particularly among Jungians. It's strange. You go to other disciplines, they listen, but not among Jungians. They all know better.
How about that? It starts there on chapter 6.
So. Oh, in other disciplines, you're saying? Maybe. Okay, quick review. We talked about two main things. Last time we looked at all of Pauli's contradictions as they show up in texts, and we'll see that as we go along. I don't really want to harp on it. I don't want to turn you against the guy, but I think you do need to see what his problems are. And really, the art of this work is being able to shuttle between two worlds: your resentment of the person, and not really of the person, but where they're not living up to their own mark. And the fact that the unconscious is trying its darndest to get them to see what they need to see. So we looked at those. We'll be looking at those some more, although I won't dwell on them like I did last time. And the other thing we began to talk about is this image of the Chinese woman. I give you a whole bunch of different characteristics of what von Franz thought was the Chinese mind. I think probably the couple of the biggest points are subsumed under the idea of synchronicity. That there's this thing called the Tao, which is that there is a way to live. There's a way to go. And the Chinese character for Tao is head over path. That you find your path and you walk it consciously. Another implication of synchronicity is what we talked about. I think we talked about it as objective knowledge. Did we talk about objective knowledge? That somehow there is a knowledge in events, in material events. In other words, how does that I Ching know what's going on? Knowledge is not only limited to our individual consciousness. Which, of course, completely undercuts every Western assumption.
I have a question.
Yeah,
because I've only listened to this today since I wasn't here. But so, from our subjective point of view, then, how do we get to that objective?
Well,
is that through synchronicity?
No, I mean, I think there we have to reside in our own subjectivity. And we have to say, well, as I understand it, here's the situation. But what the Chinese contradict is that that's all there is. There is, in their mind, a knowledge apart from our knowing. So rather than just glibly say, all there is my subjective point of view, we begin to try to develop methodologies to ascertain what is knowledge. That's the difference, I think. And that's what Western philosophy has been about for 2,000 years. How do we know what we know? And they've solved the whole problem by saying, oh, it's only what you know. Well, then why have certain paintings elicited similar reactions for millennia or decades or centuries? There's got to be some other common element. But I think in interpersonal interchange, the best way to proceed is to say, here's my point of view. Knowing that what we're really about is trying to get to some deeper knowledge beyond our point of view. But no,
by being in it,
and I think here is where human discourse comes in. How do you see it? How do you see it? How do you see it? And what are common elements to our viewing? And over the last 2,000 years, what have been the common elements in viewing? And can we begin to see that there are common threads among those viewings to help us distinguish what is true and what's insanity? It's just all the fashion these days that it's just your point of view. That's what I was sort of reacting against, which is true in practice, but in theory I think there's more to it. And that's what the Chinese view holds. Something in those coins has a knowledge as well as what's in you.
They're working together.
And then try to find a method to understand them. Jung's method is basically historical amplification. So if you have a dream of an eagle, he asks, what has the eagle always meant? Now, it doesn't mean it means that for you now, but it means it might be what that means for you now. And if it isn't, why is there a difference? Are you nuts or are you a genius? Are you bringing a new meaning to an old understanding? And if you are, get ready for the battle.
Could we say that the fact that the I Ching exists and functions as it does speaks to the idea that certain human beings do connect with absolute knowledge, since it was, written by humans?
That's a good question. I don't know. That's a very important question, and I don't know the answer. Are there some people who know more directly than others? There's that theory in family systems that there's always one person in the family that knows what's going on, and it's usually the scapegoat. So you talk to the kid that's the most messed up, and they'll tell you what's going on. I don't know how to answer that. I guess, from just the human... I mean, really, this isn't so much a psychological issue as a political issue, that we live in a democracy, and everybody's point of view is one vote. And Jung respected that very much. So that's the basis I would proceed on, more that I would try to hear everybody's point of view, rather than say there is one person that has the truth, although that might be. But it doesn't get you very far in community living.
It's a problem.
Yeah, it's a big problem. Particularly today when the whole world is cynicism. Now that I don't agree with. And I also don't agree with, the old absolutism, but somewhere Jung is trying to find, I think, a place in between. Things do mean something. Now how do we go about knowing them as best we can? There is methodology involved.
You defined postmodernism last week. Is that the opinion thing?
Yeah, I mean, Tom knows more about this than me, but I think the basic idea is that everything is a point of view.
Uh-huh. That's how I thought.
Yeah, it's all story, and you can stitch together the story in any way you want. And each has equal validity.
Right.
Which is kind of democratic on one level, I think, now, but also leads to a certain type of narcissism in our materialistic culture, where it creates problems.
I thought that thing I liked what she said is that that postmodern, that point of view, that everything is a point of view, is a point of view. And if you don't agree with that point of view, you're out.
Might explain why Jung's not taught much in academia.
Well, I thought that's what I liked about her article, that is so, I mean, I was over at Butler the other day just having a coffee outside the little cafe before class, and I heard teachers talking. This was the discussion, you know. Everything is a point of view. And if you try to go beyond your point of view, you're an authoritarian so-and-so. And I think that is exactly why Jung is not liked. Because there are certain truths that have always been. And he doesn't say that's what they have to be now. But he does say you have to reckon with what has always been.
Well, he considers those psychological facts.
Psychological facts, right.
Yeah.
Okay. I think one more thing, what's so dangerous about the pop interpretation of quantum mechanics is it goes just in this direction. You know, if they look at the experiment one way, the electron is a particle. If they look at the experiment in another way, the electron is a wave. And that's what the bleep was saying, that the world is what you see it to be, purely subjective. And none of the founders interpreted it that way. But that's the way it's been interpreted. Okay, shall we go to the Dream 19 on 73? Any other questions?
Did you like Elf? Since I was gone, did you get into the Verdant One Elf?
No, we didn't. We just touched on it.
Yeah.
I received a manuscript from, must be the Chinese. I'm afraid they will take it back. So I bring it to a place the Chinese do not know about. I have not yet read the manuscript. Well, could it be more clear? He is now... Remember, he's had all these dreams about having to write essays, and we're going to see that continues. And now what he's supposed to write about is the Chinese point of view. And that's why I went through all those characteristics at the beginning. In other words, they are the elements that apparently are going to have to be included in the next shift in Western paradigm. Or not have to, but that's the direction of the shift in Western paradigm, to begin taking account of these Eastern themes. I mentioned that movie, Hiroshima on a Moor, and I just got another example of that, I think. I've got interested in Van Gogh. I'm kind of getting interested in Van Gogh again. And, you know, he was contemporary with Nietzsche. And where did Van Gogh go for his inspiration? Japan. He collected Japanese prints like crazy.
Monet.
And Monet did too? Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. Yeah. So I think you can see that's an indication where the artists are anticipating in a feeling way what is being presented to Pauli in kind of a direct way. One more, another dream. I'm not sure about this translation. Erslange, do you know what that means, Tom? Erslange? Ich spreche Erslange is what the German said. I don't know whether that's at length or after a long time.
Mm.
Either way.
At length would probably be...
Best, huh? I speak at length with a dark woman and report that I have a calling to be a professor of theoretical physics, but I am full of qualms about accepting it. In the background, I notice the stranger who appears to be impatient. Well, that's the new professorship that we've talked about again previously. I want to leave the house where I am. It is similar to the Ateha. But I realize I must first get my coat and hat from the coat closet. But there are many coats and hats there, and I can't find mine. I suddenly then observe that the stranger oversees the coat room. He comes up to me, shows me a previously hidden place in the back, and says to me, "Back there is more." I see still more coats and hats there, but not as many as were in the front. Finally, I at least find a hat with my initials, WP. But on the inside, its color is yellow. I don't recognize it as mine, and I awake, and I am still in doubt, nota bene, obviously wrongly, as to whether it is really my hat. And here's one of Polly's marvelous sentences. The dream is characteristic for the structure of my unconscious. Talk about impotent. The setup is I am not yet a professor of theoretical physics. I am to take that position, and I have resistances against it. The question is, however, what the dream means by theoretical physics. Surely something other than the normal understanding of it, and certainly in a wider sense. Physics also encompasses psychology, and in my dream theory, often has the original meaning of a particular conception or view. So I just think there we've got an image that he was really being asked by the unconscious to begin articulating these ideas that we've seen in Sophia, that we've seen in the Persian, and now we're seeing the Chinese, to begin expressing that in lectures at the Polytechnica. The yellow would be illumination.
I was kind of surprised that for the idea of the yellow, they didn't keep with the theme of the Orient, where yellow is the color of sacred earth.
Is it? That I don't know. I would have thought more orange.
Not no, yellow.
Yellow.
How did the West get cowardly out of yellow?
Well, it all goes back to Descartes. I mean, it starts there. His basic distinction was that the world was made up of two parts, a thinking part and a objective part. And everything has stayed there. And that was what? 1540, I think, something like that? Or was it a little later, maybe? Do you know? Anyone know their history? Right around that time, 16th, 17th century. And that whole genre of the life in objects gets squashed. You don't see it in literature after Descartes. If you look at the Grail legend, you look at any of those medieval legends, the swords talk, the brooks talk, there's magic in stones. You can see that they are still not at odds with there being a thinking in nature. But with the with Descartes, that all stops. All the literature then becomes about human thought, freedom, and emotion, which in a way is beautiful, but it misses that other dimension. And that's at least how he takes it. I don't know whether you could, I couldn't contradict what Carol says or not. You actually might have a point, because later he's going to have dreams of sun shining in the laboratory. I don't know if was that in what you read. And wasn't sure I agreed with his interpretation, because on the one hand he says sun doesn't belong in laboratories, and yet he interprets it in a positive way. So I felt, you see, that's where moonlight needed to shine in those laboratories, not sunlight. And so if I think we have to say here that the yellow is a good thing. So maybe the good thing is the Oriental Earth.
All the labs I've been in are really got huge windows and lots of...
Well, but this was in the days before they had electronic measurements of nuclear, of atomic phenomena. They were still playing with light. The way, remember the way they came across this was the spectral lines? And like the way Bohr, the way Bohr, who was the guy before Bohr? He taught in Canada. Rutherford. The way Rutherford discovered the atom was shooting particles through an atom, through a gas in a dark room, and watching the little flashes of light. So at that time, they would have been watching the not electronically measuring the reactions. I'm pretty sure that's right. And of course, what we can see in the drink is resistance. I don't recognize it as mine. Which means he doesn't recognize that this is his task. And the hat, I think, would just mean a new identity. I remember once being in a little train station in Germany at the border, and I was buying a ticket, I think, and the guy came up, put on his hat and sold me a ticket, and I said to him, there was an information booth across the way, I said, I would like some information about the town I'm going to. He sold me the ticket, took off his hat, walked over to the other booth, put on the other hat, and gave me the information. Yeah, it's cute. But it also shows that a hat, you know, is a role. And he couldn't give information in the role of a ticket seller. He had to give information in the role of an information giver.
Yeah, I was just thinking, sitting on the bike, because I think it was hat and relationship. But it's interesting if you look back at how they make the objects dead, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly right.
That's a way of gaining distance. It's a way of gaining distance from the objects and becoming unrelated so that you can have more power.
That is the crux of the matter. Absolutely. The reason we can turn a city into such a pile of strip malls is we have no feeling for matter. It becomes that specific. And, yeah.
Would you say at any point it was necessary for abolition?
That's Jung's position. Yeah.
That it wasn't avoidable.
That it was not avoidable.
Yeah, that's
better. It's funny we're talking about this because I'm taking this medieval French class and we're reading French literature from about the 9th century up through the Renaissance. And we've just finished courtly literature, and which is right before the humanists and the Renaissance. And of course, in all this courtly stuff, you see that when the hero gets into a jam, his sword will tell him what to do, or the sword will do something, or the rocks will speak, or something like that. And then when you get to the humanist, there is none of that. The other thing that happens is up to that time, there's no relationship between men and women. It's all idealized. The knight and the queen. And the queen is perfect, but unattainable. And after that, they begin having relationships. And the poetry begins to be about the relationship, not about the fantasy of serving somebody. So apparently there had to be a shift in consciousness to make us able to see reality as it was, probably for several reasons, but one of the reasons being that we could begin to relate to each other as people and not as, in our language, not as a transference. And so that fantasy had to be cut out in reality, put in its place. The advantage was obvious, but the disadvantage is that we are now having to come back and look at. Well, he just cites her now, him, starting up a relationship with Frau Jaffe. It goes without saying that you are considerably closer to me, both spiritually and humanly, than Fräulein von Franz. Mm-hmm. Ooh. I was very impressed yesterday by your strong, rich feeling connection with me, and the more so since you didn't speak of it.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And yet, you know, a few years later he's going to walk in and insult her and walk out. So that's the borderline. And really, the one who was the closest to him was von Franz, spiritually. Jaffe was just kind of a wallflower. It gets worse. I am not getting any further with my own problems, and the dreams also give me so little clues at the moment. What does he want? In physics, I am occupied with a mass of details. So I am somewhat worried how anything will evolve. How can anything develop from here? And yet he's getting one dream after the other saying the same thing. Lecture, lecture, lecture. Other friends and acquaintances sink themselves in politics or in therapy without pause, as in CA equals F. CA is CA Meyer. F was his nickname, Freddie. He was a psychiatrist. Why shouldn't he devote his life to therapy? I am critical of such solutions because these love stories occur with the left hand. And we're going to talk about the left hand in a minute. But the dream seemed to say that what I am dealing with in the inner reality, in the reality of my life, has to do with a general problem. That is not untrue, but it's also talking about his version of it. And I don't think one can interpret around that or interpret it away. I am perhaps not intelligent enough or not strong enough in my feeling or both to be able to get anywhere further. But whenever I come to your retreat at Neumark's the little area where she lived, my situation seems somewhat more full of hope. Until in this spirit, we hopefully meet again. Sad. I talked to you about C. A. Meyer. I like what the author writes, the last three sentences on 74. He was suffering under the fact that he was alone with the problem of having to build a bridge between physics on the one hand and the world of therapy on the other. In reality, he wasn't alone. The bridge he was looking for is already present in his relationship with Marie-Louise von Franz. That is evident from the fact that this theme was at the center of von Franz's interests. Um, You okay so far? The next bit, we applies to the beginnings of a series of books called Studies from the C.G. Jung Institute. I think the first volume was that volume that you might have seen called The Interpretation of Nature and the Psyche. It was an essay by Jung on synchronicity, and it was Pauly's essay on Kepler. Did we talk about the essay on Kepler? Don't know if we did or not. We will get to it, but what Pauly did was go back to the birth of the scientific revolution, and he took a conflict between two exponents that was either published or done in letters, I'm not sure, published even, between an alchemist named Robert Fludd, who was English, and Kepler, the astronomer, who was a scientist. And they argued their points of view. And of course, you know, there was no meeting ground. And Pauly went back to that diatribe and wrote about it to show that they both had equal points of view. That when science was coming to birth, the alchemical point of view had to be squashed. But from our later vantage point, we are now in a position of uniting those two. And he took those two guys' argument as a way to hear the two points of view, and then to say what we have to do in science now is to try to build a bridge between what for them was a conflict. Their argument are now our two poles that we have to synthesize, the scientific and the I say alchemical, I mean that whole worldview that sees matter as alive versus matter being dead. So Jung published his article on synchronicity, and Pauly published that his essay called, I forget what it was called. We'll get to it. And von Franz wanted to be included. And I'm not sure what the deal was. I know Meyer was my supervisor. I loved him, but I don't say he was perfect. He was jealous of von Franz. And I think he saw to it that was not published. Her article on Descartes was not published. And it was a dirty deal. He and Jung eventually had a falling out. And I don't know what the story was. I wondered if it was something about this. You know, you might think that these authors of Jung's caliber have free say in how their books are published, but they don't. You know, they have to jump through editorial boards, and who knows who, and whose cousin is sleeping with whose nephew, and what decisions are made at the publishing company. He didn't always get to pick the title of his books. He didn't always agree with the way they were edited, but he had to go along with it because he wanted to get them published. I think this might have been one of those situations where, up to him, he would have said include her, but it kind of got taken out of his hands. So she was mad. She wanted to, and that, I passed around that article on Descartes, I think, last time. It was published in the second volume of Studies from the C.G. Jung Institute, but it lost a certain energy in its being relegated to the second volume. It's certainly worthy in quality of Jung's work and Pauly's work, and would have made a nice trilogy. But that's what he's talking about here. I jumped ahead a little bit, sorry. He's just introducing Descartes. We'll get to that story later. But what he's doing now is showing us that, on page 75, is that von Franz's work was of this quality. We'll get to the fact that essay was excluded later. The left hand. Remember, he referred to Meyer's connection to therapy as a left-hand connection. And the author is maintaining that von Franz and Pauli had this erotic fascination with each other, which is another example of a left-hand connection. That's a word from alchemy and from the essay, from the series of pictures and the descriptions of them called the Rosarium Philosophorum. He mentions it there in the third paragraph. He was referring to this because, in his view, von Franz and Pauli have a transference. As I've said, I don't like that word. But I might put it differently, but I think this idea of the left-hand connection is still valid. And I thought we'd spend a little time talking about what that is. I brought along some of you have probably seen me, brought along these pictures from that text. Oh yeah, we did this in Psychology of Transference. I'm just adding this, so what he says here makes sense. And just to backtrack why I'm saying it, he accused Meyer of this left-hand relationship with psychology, and that's not that important. But what the author says is, well, yeah, there's a left-hand relationship going on, Pauli, and it's your relationship with von Franz. So I thought, let's take a little time to understand what a left-hand relationship is. And it's not something negative. That's what I want to try to drive home to you. So just hold that thought, and we'll go through this text very, 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 very quickly. And I'll explain what this text is about, and then I'll bring it back and I'll apply it to this left-hand business, which is the nature of von Franz's and Pauli's fascination with each other. And what he has to accept and is loath to accept, and why. Well, this is I think it's 10 woodcuts from an alchemical text called the Rosarium Philosophorum, 1550. Jung interpreted this as the basis of his article, The Psychology of the Transference. Now, if you watch the evolution of Jung's idea of transference, he started out, like Freud, seeing it as a projection of things you don't know about your past experience with parents onto the therapist. So that the feelings between the therapist and the client are based on unknown repetitions of the past. That's Freud. Jung said no. Sometimes, maybe, but way, 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 way too narrow. You'll hear him in his middle writings talk about transference, namely the erotic feelings between a therapist and client, male, female. I've never worked with gays, but I bet it's no, I mean, gays don't project on me. But I could imagine a gay therapist and a gay client could have the same thing. I don't think it'd be any different. That the reason these fascinations start is because there's a breach in the relationship and these fantasies come up to reestablish a rapport. That's middle Jung. He also disregarded that. This is his final point of view. Now I will just interpret the alchemical text and then I'll interpret it. And then I'll interpret it psychologically. What goes on, this alchemical text says, you start out And in that material that's being cooked is a fountain, where two constituent parts, a sun and a moon, are balanced around the axis of the fountain. So the sun and the moon would be the two, in their mind, chemical parts in that raw material. As it's cooked, the fountain, which would be the possibility of transformation, becomes the reality of change. So it disappears. The fountain just symbolizes what's going to come. So when it starts coming, it's no longer needed to be symbolized. And what happens is the sun and the moon separate more clearly, and a king and a queen stand on them. So in their mind, the conflicting chemical elements in that base material separate, and a king and queenly aspect of them arise. This is the medieval mind, remember. Now look how they are connected. See, their left hands are connected, and their right hands are connected.
Well, the left hands are connected directly, and the right hands are connected through the extensions.
Right. Mm-hmm. But look what happens in the next one. Thank you, Mary Healy.
I want to point that out in case anybody knows that.
We missed that one.
Look at their hands.
Their hands are connected directly.
All of them are connected through that structure.
And what's coming down is the dove.
And what's coming down is the dove. Yeah, beautiful. So, just hold that thought. That's really part of our discussion that's meaningful, but let's just go through it. So they are activated. They come into a new kind of contact with each arm holding one aspect of that piece that's between them. With the dove, of course. The dove would be the spirit, the reconciliation capacity. They sit in the bath. So it starts getting hot for them. And they unite. It's a sexual union. And Jung is... hang on. I don't want to interpret. I'll interpret it next. They unite. They die. And that dove now becomes the little man that rises.
Which one?
See, they die. One, two, three. They're dead. And then something. Can you just?
They're dead.
They're dead. All well. They're dead in the third and fourth picture on the second row. And but on the fourth picture, there's a little man that has emerged from their corpse.
And that's the homunculus. Transformed dove?
Well, that's the transformed dove. That's the healing capacity that has emerged from the death, which flies up and fructifies consciousness. That's the dew. And he returns. In the second picture, in the fourth, on the third line. I believe that's a crow. Meaning that during that phase, you're depressed. I believe that's right.
So the homunculus returns to the body?
To the body, and it's reborn a unity, or a synthesis.
Which one is that?
The last, the hermaphrodite.
Okay. Wait, I was talking about this one.
He's coming down. You see, here he's gone up, And his effect, you don't see him there anymore, but his effect is seen in the dew. So that would be the healing effect in consciousness of what's happened in the unconscious.
And then the next one is...
He's returning. You just see him up here. I tried to put this all on one sheet, but you can get a magnifying glass at home if you want.
I can see it.
He's returning. And you see, this is the dark night of the soul. Healing is going on, but you feel like... You feel awful. This is when you wish you were dead. And you are dead. That's the funny thing. Don't kill yourself, you're already dead. The healing effect now returns to the unconscious and transforms the unconscious. So both the conscious, represented by the sky and the clouds, and the unconscious, represented by the conflict, are transformed.
And then the last one?
That's the transformed sun and the moon. But you see, the moon is the only one that's remaining. Meaning it's feminine consciousness that's so important.
What about that plant there? Are those spaces in the
plant? He says something about that. I mean, I can't remember exactly what it is. It's some illusion. You know, if you have Psychology of the Transference, you could look at these. He gives a couple pages on each picture.
Okay. Are there snakes in both hands? Or
there's
looks like there's a cup in one.
I think one's a cup, but I don't know what's in it. And yes, the other one would be a snake.
And then a different bird.
Right. Yeah.
Is that the three-headed serpent guy?
It might be. It might be Mercurius in the in what would be his right hand. And the left would be probably the, you know, the
sun moon tree.
Well, that snake I think would be the poison that heals. I'm not sure. It's been a while. We did this one seminar, but it's been a while since I've done it, so I forgot all of it. All the details.
So these would be the basic symbols of an alchemy.
This is one alchemical recipe.
Oh, okay.
And Jung thought it was so relevant because it is kind of paradigmatic, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is actually a recipe. And then they would write tomes about what it really meant. But now, for our purposes, it's the left hand.
Left-hand path.
Left-hand path and the left-hand attraction are those uncomfortable, erotic attractions that pull you to people that you would ordinarily not particularly care to be pulled to. It's all those fascinations, and I think... largely of an erotic nature that bridge you to situations and get you into dilemmas that your reason knows, no, don't do that. But you say, screw reason.
Why is it called that?
Well, because it's... The idea of the right hand would be what's acceptable, and the left hand's what's not acceptable. So that's the transference. The left-hand connection is the transference. It's the feelings that pull you to somebody that don't make logical sense. But you see, that is the beginning of the union. And it starts being left hand, but in the next picture, it becomes united with the... it's the basis on which that dove can come in. If there had been no left hand connection, there couldn't be... the left hand would not have been brought in to that four pronged element, and there would be no dove. There would be no series of pictures. So not only is it not a nuisance, it is the propeller that moves this process of transformation. And I think that's why Jung interpreted these pictures, because it shows that irony so clearly. When it's a left to left, it's a problem, but if you can accept the left to left and bring that into connection with the right to right, then the ghost, then the Holy Spirit comes in and the transformation can occur. If the first and the second picture is left to left, and we're saying, well, that's the unconscious nature of the attraction. And one is attempted to moralize about it, or to judge it in terms of its rational futility. But if it's accepted, and it's brought into relation to the right hand, which would be the conscious evaluation of the experience, and the two work together, and you are connected to the other person, both with the left and the right, through that structure, then the dove can enter, and that dove would be what moves the transformation.
Oh, so he doesn't come in until after you do both left and right.
Correct.
Okay.
What's the difference is San Vishan between the third and fourth picture?
Just that the in the fourth picture, you're sitting in the hot water. Sitting in hot water.
Okay.
And, you know, Jung's basic model of therapy is both the therapist and the client sit in the bathtub. That's why we don't try to be objective.
That's kind of like letting that transparent situation, let it go and see where it goes.
Exactly. Consciously.
What I find really fascinating about the second picture is that the dove is accompanied by a star. And if you think about that as Sophia being behind that.
Remember that beautiful quote by Sybil Hurkhäuser, one of my heroes. Do you remember what page was on?
Yeah, it was 64. Yeah.
The conscious mind cannot note advance what the unconscious intends to achieve by a transference. Her use of the word transference I like. You see what the word transference means, like there's something wrong, not real. And this is the foundation of reality. And should for that rather wait until its purpose is revealed by the unconscious itself. And this is the answer to the star and the bird. It has been demonstrated that one cannot come into contact with the transcendental background of one's own psyche. That's the star. Without a relationship to another person. That's the left and right hand holding thing. Being in connection. So through that fascination, you come into a recognition of what the star, what the pattern, what the purpose of your life is to be. That's why I'm so skittish around the terminology, because it is really the highest process of life. And just to give it a label bothers me somehow. Well, now you can hopefully see his use of the word left hand is so inappropriate when it comes to Meyer, as if it's something wrong. And then the author says, yep, there's a left-hand connection, all right, and it's your connection to von Franz. And again, there's nothing bad about it, but the left hand just indicates the uncomfortable nature and the upsetting nature of this fascination. But as if you can keep that picture in mind, it says much more than any words can say. That left-hand uncomfortable connection is what allows the deeper process to proceed. And out of that comes something of another dimension, a much higher nature.
What is the
Pauli
statement then about seeing
higher
having a
left-hand
relationship?
Well, Pauli thought that Jung's psychology, how can I say it? You know, that he had this grand vision of things, and Jungian analysts were just little pedants who didn't fully see what Jungian psychology would become. And in his mind, it would become some objective science. Which sounds good until you realize what he's really saying is, I don't want to have to deal with my feelings in this. So he was critical of a guy like Meyer. And they were good buddies. But here he's being negative towards him. That all he's interested in is Jungian psychology in its application to therapy. And he, Wolfgang Pauli, sees its much broader uses, and that those much broader uses is where it will evolve in the future, leaving people like therapists in the dust. So, anytime that you would try to get him to look at the emotional situation of his life, you were asking him to be a pedant, just like those stupid therapists. Now, I think it is true in a way. He had part of the truth. I think Jung's psychology, or let me say it differently. I think there's a new point of view going on in the unconscious, trying to be born. And just about everything. And Jung just happened to pick that up. Jung is just articulating. It's not Jung. I guess that's one reason why I defend him. It really isn't about Jung. It's about a new way of looking at life trying to be born. He just happened to tune into the right station. And I do think, in that sense, Pauli is right, that it is going to evolve, or this point of view that Jung has tapped into is going to evolve. But it is also never going to be apart from the individual human being. He thinks it will separate. I don't think it ever will. In other words, that our own subjectivity is going to be brought back into the way we understand life.
Would you please say that again, that idea? a new thing is trying to be born.
Yeah, just say take the Chinese, or take Sophia, or take the Persian. What they are doing is showing us that within the unconscious, a new Western paradigm is trying to be born. And it will have the features, or it will include the features that we've been talking about, that we talked about last time. I'm pretty sure about that. That has nothing to do with Jung. That just has to do with the way the collective unconscious is trying to address how we need to grow to meet the demands of the time. And all Jung did was listen to that. He discovered the tools to be able to listen to that. And Pauli, I think, in a way, knew that. That was his greatness. But it was so threatening to him emotionally that he had to separate it from therapy. We're not just coming upon a new paradigm of knowing or science or religion, but we are going to have a different relationship to that.
That
new paradigm.
Oh.
To this new paradigm, which may have a scientific and a religious dimension to it.
But we don't have one now.
The old paradigm says you don't have to have one. The new paradigm is going to be saying there is no separation between you and what you're seeing. So Pally got it half right, but he thinks you can get the person out of there, and I don't think you'll ever be able to. So that individual work in therapy and the growth in the paradigm, they're parallel phenomena. Jungian psychology is never going to transcend the analytic hour, as he said it would.
Now, what does he mean by that again? How does it transcend?
Well, that our understanding now is so small and so narrow, and we will get a further understanding that will show just how small and narrow our current grasp of Jung is, or even Jung's grasp of things. And the real effect of Jung is going to be in transforming science, transforming philosophy, transforming religion. And if you were really on top of things, that's what you'd be about. You wouldn't be about working with your dreams. But see, I don't think they're two separate things.
And you're also saying that was his way of...
And at the same time, it was his defense.
Separating
from the left-hand back, because he figured that was something bad. But that's part of the new paradigm. You get to where you're going through this bumpy road.
It says in here, too, that was the goal from Marie's sometimes, that she actually, science and religion, bring together.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, I would say that is them just listening. All these people have done is listen inside. And watched how images are coming up that are in direct conflict with the Western way of looking at things, and realizing from their experience in personal work how images precede shifts in consciousness. But that's what they're seeing in these images, a shift in general consciousness. And they don't know what it's going to be like, but they can begin to speculate. And that's what this course is about, trying to speculate. And that Pauli was tied to von Franz through a left-hand path, and that was so important because this transformation, that was to be him and his view of science and religion. And this is how it starts. It starts in the most uncomfortable fashions. And what I love about the pictures, that little detail becomes a part of the whole, and a crucial part of the whole, and even the engine that drives. And that's what, we'll stop in a second, that's what Jung is saying there in the middle paragraph. Maybe I should just read and then we'll stop. The gesture points to a closely guarded secret, to the left-hand path, as the India tantrists call their Shiva Shakti worship. You know, Shiva Shakti was the two gods in the belly that turned into the snake which arose. The left is inauspicious and awkward. Also, it is the side of the heart from which comes not only love, but all the evil thoughts connected with it. The moral contradictions in human nature that are expressed most clearly in our affective life. See, this is not theory. The contact of the left hands could therefore be taken as an indication of the affective nature of the relationship, of its dubious character, since this is a mixture of heavenly and earthly love, further complicated by an incestuous sus entendu. Entendu is under, what's entendu?
It's under understanding.
Under understanding, or beneath understanding,
yeah.
Deeper than understanding. So that, see, that left hand connection would be, that's incest for Freud. And Freud's saying, oh, that's no, that's bad, you see. Jung is saying, no, that's a starting point. Underneath that is a wealth of understanding if you know how to get to it.